www.radiofreeplay.com/en.
The headlines. The Yemeni army once again threatens the UAE with further attacks, advising the country to leave the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen. In brazen support for Israel's crimes against Palestinians, the U.S. rejects the view that the regime's actions amount to apartheid. And finally, at least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. receive threats of bomb attacks and mass shootings as the Black History Month begins. Welcome to the program. Sana'a renews its warning to the UAE to end its aggression against Yemeni people. In a tweet, Army spokesman Yahya Sari noted that the safety of the expo being held in Dubai depends on the UAE's conduct. Sari had earlier warned that the UAE will come under continued strikes as long as its targets Yemeni people. On Monday, the Yemeni army launched a third operation against the United Arab Emirates, hitting significant targets, including sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. The UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that has been waging a war on Yemen since March of 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. Let's discuss this a little bit further with the help of Mr. Jason Andro. He's a political commentator who comes to you live via Skype out of Niagara Falls. Jason, your understanding of the situation, do you think this is the continuation of perhaps the previous phases, or a totally new phase has begun?
I tend to suspect that this may be a start of a new phase. I mean, it's very clear at this time that Saudi Arabia is going to lose the war. After, you know, probably hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent trying to fund the destruction and the genocide of the Yemeni people, and it has not made any significant gain whatsoever. I mean, this is about trying to control Yemen, and that is something that they do not have, despite the overwhelming amount of resources that they have put into it. I think that it's really one of those things where Saudi Arabia realizes it's losing and is trying to gain support from other states in order to continue, you know, their quest against Yemen. And the UAE seems to be relatively good to go along with it, to give them whatever kind of support, at least political support to some degree, and I highly suspect material support in the background or whatever form that it might take. And that this, of course, would lead the Yemenis to bring the war to the UAE, as we have seen on at least one occasion. And then, you know, we're having them say that they're not afraid to strike out at basically anyone who's going to support the destruction of their country and the slaughter of their people. So maybe, because I'm not really a war strategist kind of person, but it does seem like Saudi Arabia is looking for help. I mean, that, at least that's how it appears to my eyes. I mean, that wasn't how it was done at the beginning, but this change has been made. So I think that it is a change to some degree, but exactly what it is probably only in the heads of the Saudi planners themselves.
And how seriously do you think the UAE is going to take these threats, given the fact that, Jason, within the past 1 or 2 weeks, you know, Abu Dhabi itself was targeted by one of these drones? So basically, I think, you know, this is not an empty threat. How do you think the Emiratis are going to take this?
As you just said, the Yemenis have already demonstrated not just a willingness, but a capability to strike at the UAE itself. I mean, I think, you know, the UAE is, you know, one of the richest countries in the world, but everybody has their limits, and everybody, you know, investors can be very, very shaky, and, you know, that's kind of the point for Yemen to fire back, is to create that kind of uncertainty in investment, and I'm sure that's probably what it is they're aiming for, like this. And the Emiratis are very, they know that's what this is about, and they know why it's happening, and they realize how much of a serious danger that would actually put in the economy. So I do see the response being probably very serious. I wouldn't be surprised if some kind of anti-missile system showed up in the future, or, you know, something like that. There's definitely going to be a response, because there's no way they can actually live with that kind of risk in their country. Not only would, you know, that kind of foment unrest at home if it got bad enough, but in terms of investment and economy in general, it's certainly a bad thing.
And, you know, one last thing before you go, Jason, do you think this is, again, you know, perhaps a jump start to ruin the Emirati-Israeli plans? Let's say, I'm sure you do know about this, let's say on the Socotra Island, you know, that is a Yemeni island, and, you know, the plans that they had together for that island and elsewhere around the Yemeni ports. Do you think this is perhaps a serious beginning to ruining those plans?
I would suspect so. Anything that it, you know, where it trying to take advantage of Yemen is going to be treated very seriously. There is the old expression that war is politics with guns, and politics is war without guns. But I would also add my own caveat there, to add economics into the mix with that particular expression. And I think that's going to play a major role. I mean, it's very clear that the Saudi and everybody else alliance, this is not about humanitarian. You're not going to appeal to their conscience, because for nonviolence to, you know, the old saying, for nonviolence to work, your opponent must first have a conscience. So I think it's going to come down to economic factors, and I think that's definitely going to play a part.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Jason Andrew, political commentator. Your Skype out of Niagara Falls. You have a very good time. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the U.S. and Israel are the real enemies of Muslims, exploiting divisions among the Muslim Ummah and to achieve their goals. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the policy of the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia on Yemen is in line with Israeli stance, as evidenced by a recent trip by Israel's president to the UAE. He noted that Saudi Arabia allowed a plane carrying the Israeli delegation to fly over the kingdom while it prevents Yemeni people from using their own airspace. He said Israel and its loyalists consider Yemeni people as their common enemy. Houthi slammed the Saudi-led coalition's recent airstrike on a prison in northern Yemen as a deliberate attempt to create a massacre. He said the coalition bombed the prison while the United Nations and other international bodies were aware of the location of the facility. The United States rejects the view that Israel's actions towards the Palestinians constitute apartheid. The spokesperson for the U.S. State Department said they have never used such terminology. Ned Price referred to the Israeli regime as the world's only Jewish state, saying Jews must not be denied their rights to self-determination. Their remarks come after the international rights group accused Israel of apartheid for its treatment of Palestinians. The claim also prompted an angry response from Tel Aviv, which has denounced the report as anti-Semitic. Meanwhile, Iran has condemned Israel for following racist, expansionist policies. Tehran says Israel remains as the only apartheid regime in the world, despite outstanding calls from the international community to stop its violations of Palestinians' rights, I should say. Political commentator Jim Kavanaugh says Israel is blatantly an apartheid regime, and while everybody has accepted this, the U.S. rejects it, with President Joe Biden calling himself a Zionist.
Israeli human rights group B'Tselem itself says that Israel is an apartheid regime from the river to the sea. Human Rights Watch says this is apartheid. This is the privileging of one religious ethnic group over another. To be specific, it's ethno-religious supremacism of the, you know, of a blatant kind. It's clear that the Jewish population is fully enfranchised in a way that the Palestinian Arabs never will be. Palestinian Arabs are worse than second class citizens. They just don't count. You know, a Jewish person from anywhere in the world has the right to arrive in Israel and have fully enfranchised rights. Palestinians who live there for decades and centuries and generations are losing their homes and their land under the rubric of Jewish supremacy. That's what this is about. You know, you can't. It's a colonialist situation. Has been from the beginning. It was instituted at the end of World War II when colonialism was still kind of something you could think of as okay. And the Palestinian Arabs just were not as important as the European Jews who were coming from displaced persons camps. So, you know, everybody's accepted this. The United States, Joe Biden, called himself a Zionist.
At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. received threats of mass shootings and bomb attacks. The threats in cities from Baltimore to New Orleans has forced authorities to enforce campus lockdowns. This coincides with the first day of the U.S. Black History Month. On Monday, a wave of similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools. The White House says it takes these threats, quote, incredibly seriously, but that they still do not know what has motivated the threats. Last year, the U.S. intelligence services warned that racially motivated violent extremists, such as white supremacists, would seek to carry out mass casualty attacks in the country. The Russian president warns against U.S. attempts to drag his country into a war, saying Washington is not concerned about the security of Ukraine.
The most important U.S. goal is to contain Russia. That's the thing. In this sense, Ukraine itself is just a tool to achieve this goal. This can be done in different ways. One of them is to draw us into some armed conflict.
Vladimir Putin made the remark during a joint press conference with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The Russian leader said, "It's wrong to allow one country to increase its security at the expense of another." Putin also accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring proposals Moscow delivered to Washington for security guarantees over NATO's eastward expansion. Meanwhile, the Russian foreign minister said his country would continue insisting on its security demands. Tensions escalated in recent months amid Western accusations that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly rejected the accusations. The conclusions of a much-anticipated inquiry into allegations of parties held at the UK Prime Minister's office during lockdowns of last year is finally out. Although published in its redacted form, the report has fueled anger among the public, political opposition, and members of Boris Johnson's own Conservative Party. Sai Pureza is in London.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building in penitent mode again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously. The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purezep, London.
Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali has been present at this year's ceremonies and filed a report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new analysis published recently revealed that Georgia residents experienced a dramatic increase in mail-in ballot rejections during last year's municipal elections, a development the report's authors say is attributable to the state's recently enacted Republican-led voter suppression law. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Analysis finds a staggering rise in voter suppression after GOP restrictions in Georgia. Here's more. A new analysis published recently revealed that Georgia residents experienced a dramatic increase in mail-in ballot rejections during last year's municipal elections. A development the report's authors say is attributable to the state's recently enacted Republican-led voter suppression law. According to reporters Ryan Little and Ari Berman, during municipal elections in November, Georgia voters were 45 times more likely to have their mail ballot applications rejected and ultimately not vote as a result than in 2020. If that same rejection rate were extrapolated to the 2020 race, more than 38,000 votes would not have been cast in a presidential contest decided by just over 11,000 votes. In November 2021, Georgians who successfully obtained mail ballots were also twice as likely to have those ballots rejected once they were submitted compared to the previous year. If that were the case in 2020, about 31,000 fewer votes would have been cast in the presidential election. Election law attorney Mark E. Elias, who along with colleagues won 64 of the 65 lawsuits challenging Joe Biden's 2020 victory, reacted to the Mother Jones report by tweeting, "This is why we are fighting this new law in court. Democracy is on the docket." Elias was referring to SB 202, which was signed into law by Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, last March. As Common Dreams reported at the time, the legislation imposed strict voter identification requirements, significantly limited to the use of absentee ballot drop boxes, eliminated mobile voting vans, and made it a crime to give water to people waiting in line to vote. Little and Berman assert that the disenfranchisement that occurred in the last year's Georgia municipal elections was a direct result of measures to limit mail voting passed by the GOP legislature. More than half of mail ballot applications were rejected because they arrived after the state's newly imposed deadline to request them, they write. In 2020, Georgia voters could request the mail ballot up until the Friday before Election Day. Under the new law signed by Governor Brian Kemp in March 2021, voters must place their request no later than 11 days before the election, which voting rights advocates say is too early and burdensome for many voters. In 2020, more than 21,000 Georgians, including Kemp, who requested his ballot on Election Day, cast their ballots within 11 days of the November 3rd contest, something that is no longer possible due to the new law. Kemp also dropped off his ballot on Election Day, which is now prohibited, as the law he signed cuts off drop box access 4 days before the election. The reporters write, these rejections are having a disproportionate impact on Democratic-leaning constituencies. Black voters, who make up about a third of the electorate in Georgia, accounted for half of all late ballot application rejections, according to the voting rights group Fair Fight Action. Voters 18 to 29 made up just 2.76% of mail voters in 2021, but they constituted 15% of late ballot application rejections. Overall, four times as many Democratic voters requested mail ballots compared to Republicans, they say so, is an increase in rejections will particularly harm their party. The new analysis belies claims by Republicans and right-wing Democratic Senator Joe Manchin that states are not engaged in voter suppression, and the report's authors suggest the data could portend widespread voter disenfranchisement resulting from GOP-led legislation in the 2022 midterm and 2024 general elections. The truly troubling aspect of these numbers is that municipal voters tend to be much more experienced voters, super voters, if you will, who are less likely to make these sorts of errors, like returning their ballots late. Sarah Tyndall-Gazal, a Democratic member of the Georgia State Election Board, told reporters, adding, extrapolating that to a much higher turnout election expected this year suggests that, absent a massive voter education effort, many more eligible voters will be disenfranchised by these onerous restrictions, which seems to me to have been the point. Little and Berman note that Georgia isn't the only state where voters are experiencing difficulty casting ballots due to restrictions enacted by Republican-controlled state legislatures. In one example reported by Common Dreams earlier this month, a number of Texas counties are experiencing an alarming number of mail ballots being rejected in the wake of SB 1, a law signed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott last September. In Travis County, home to Austin, the state capital, around half of all mail-in ballot applications have been rejected. According to Brennan Center for Justice, 19 states passed 34 laws last year, making it harder to vote. Advocates warn of a tidal wave of GOP voter suppression heading into 2022 midterm elections. With restrictive laws coupled with former President Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, posing a serious threat to U.S. democracy, according to the Brennan Center.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us start the day by contemplating upon what the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, has said about the vicissitudes of life. The consequence of fear is disappointment, and of bashfulness is frustration. Opportunity passes away like the cloud. Therefore, make use of good opportunities.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salamullah. One of the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, was reported, said that I went and I saw the commander of the faithful in the masjid of Kufa. I saluted him and he replied to my greetings. So I said, O commander of the faithful, give me a piece of advice. Now, this is something that the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen and the Prophet used to do more often, to ask for advice. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he said to him, be good to people and God will be good to you. As simple as that. As we say in Arabic, Arhamu man fil ard, yarhamkum man fil sama. Be kind to those who dwell on earth. He who dwells in the heavens will be kind to you. That companion said, I requested him to say something more. Well, obviously this companion thinks he accomplished that mission, so he wanted more. Then the Imam alayhi salam, he says to him, Ya Nauf, if you wish to be with me on the day of judgment, you must not help the oppressors, which is basically saying the same thing. He says, if you wish to be with me on the day of judgment, we all want to be with the commander of the faithful on the day of judgment. He says then, do not help the oppressors. Now, when it comes to the oppressors, that's a sensitive issue, because an oppressor sometimes is not a person, sometimes it is a system, sometimes it is a government. And especially for us Muslims living in the West, we are supporting those oppressive governments. You might say, no, I'm not. I'll give you an example. Do you wish that the government that you're living under become unstable? Which means the government is unstable. I mean, you know, everything falls apart, like safety, security, and what have you. Obviously, you wouldn't want to live in a country where there are no safety, right? So you want them to stay in power. So you are supporting them in a way or another. So we have to be very careful that if we want to be with Amir al-Mu'mineen on the Day of Judgment, we should not support any oppressive regime or a government or a person per se. We have to stand with those who are poor. We have to stand with those who are less fortunate. We should help those who are in need. That's a requirement on me and you as Muslims. Therefore, we say that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in short, the center point of the policy of him was serving mankind, meeting their needs, and eliminating and demolishing injustice. Once the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam looked at Amir al-Mu'mineen and he said to him, O Ali, Allah has adorned you with the adornment which is the best adornment in His eyes. He adorned you with love for the weak. We need to be the same as Ali alayhi as-salam. Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners,
You're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he looks at Amir al-Mu'mineen and he says to him, "Like you, O Ali." Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you something that is the best. The best thing that He could give to anyone, He has given it to you. What is that, Ya Rasulullah? He said, the adornment of being in love with the weak. They love the weak people. Why does Ali alayhi salam love the weak people? Because he loves to take their right back and give it to them. He loves to fight for the rights of the weak. He's on a time that he sees weak people, people being killed and their rights being taken away from them. And he turns a blind eye and he said, it's not my responsibility, because if I talk, I might lose this and I might lose that. You know, I've seen a lot of people, they avoid talking about Saudis, for example, the government of Saudis, obviously. Because they said, well, if I talk about Saudis publicly and it's recorded and goes live and it gets on YouTube or Facebook or what have you, then I might get banned from entering Saudi Arabia or not doing Hajj. So sometimes we compromise on the truth for the safety of our own needs and desires, petty desires. Well, Amir al-Mu'mineen says no. So the Prophet says to him, Ali, you have that trait where you love the weak. May it be pleasing to you that they should be your followers and happy and satisfied on account of you being their imam. Those who are weak, those who are trying to defend them, they are the followers of you, O Ali, and you are in fact their imam. So we can see that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, it was his mission, his aim, to help the weak, to the point that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says to him that you are being blessed and gifted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, me and you, brothers and sisters, we call Amir al-Mu'mineen as the commander of the faithful, and we are the faithful, and he is our commander. We are his followers, which means we need to walk the walk and talk the talk, not just to talk the talk and not to walk the walk. What's the point of me calling myself a follower of Ali, but I refuse to pay charity? I refuse to help those who are in need. I refuse to sponsor an orphan, for example. I refuse to help someone who is going in a financial problem or dire financial situation. And I can see those around me. Sometimes I know some of my friends, my close friends or family members, who are suffering because of lack of money, and I don't give them. Then how good of a follower to Ali alayhi salam am I? If I have money, if I have wealth, I should support those who are close to me first and increase that circle and move beyond the family. Make sure no one's in need. Sadly, a lot of people around us, they have plenty of money, but they think it's theirs and they don't share, they don't give, because they're worried that they might not make it to tomorrow. The idea is, the reality is, whoever gave you this money is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He can take it from you at any moment. When you give it, you are not losing. You are in fact making more. You're making more hasanat, more deeds. You're creating your own heaven. And Allah, He Himself promised that when you pay to others, He will increase it tenfold. He will give you even more. So don't think that you're losing. In fact, you are gaining. Me and you need to be true followers of Ali and walk His walk and talk His talk. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Cultural news Social news Scientific news Artistic news With delight
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
And many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fear surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 5th. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar, this year's zodiac is the tiger, the symbol of strength and power. The National Zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porker pet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside-down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square roots, cube roots, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PAMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zora is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zora says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zora had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zora says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be? In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
The Indian administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat, and a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir, disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, how sport on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here, and every day I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colourful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office. In the age of technology, electronic mail, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir.